Matt Sevenar is a California licensed attorney. He has a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California, Davis, and a law degree from the University of California at Hastings College of Law. He's the author and administrator of LifeAfterTheOilCrash.net. That's linked up with CoastToCoastAM.com right now, which explains global peak oil, its ramifications, and what we can do to address it. Matt is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, George?
My pleasure. How did you get interested in this whole topic of peak oil?
Well, I was actually doing research for a drug war abolitionist group that I was starting back in the fall. And I was on a site, it's an excellent site, by the name of FromTheWilderness.com. And the gentleman who, the editor of that site, his name's Michael Ruber, he's ex-LAPD narcotic.
I know Michael. I know him.
Yeah. And so I had been reading about his writings about the war, the drug war and the CIA and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that he says, he backs up with facts. So in my mind, anytime Michael Ruber says something, I give it a lot of weight.
Right.
So back in the fall, I was doing research to get this group started and developing a website. And I'm on his site looking for drug war articles. And he's got all these articles on this thing called peak oil. Now, like most people, I was aware that, well, you know, we've got oil problems. We're in the Middle East for oil. And mm-hmm. at that time, still WMD, supposedly. And but I had never heard of the term peak oil. And the more I read, the more all the craziness that seems to have taken over the world in the last 5 years made makes perfect sense when you understand what peak oil is. And it all sort of hit me that the true scope of the situation is that the average American the idea of how big this is, they have no idea. And we're gonna get into this, of course, tonight. And I was sitting there one day at my computer, and it all hit me, the true scope of this and what it means for the industrial world, and how massive of an effect it's going to have on all of our lives in the years to come.
Well, and you're right, because so many of us really never question these commodities and how they get to us, be it oil, natural gas. We just always assume they're going to flow. I've been a proponent of an alternative energy, trying to get us into hydrogen or something else. We'll talk about that later on as well, Matt. But you're right. Most people just use it and don't really think about if it's going to be there tomorrow.
Right, right. Pump's there. It's all good.
Those statistics that I mentioned about Saudi Arabia, the fact that, you know, they're pumping 8 million barrels a day, that they've got reserves of 250 billion barrels. And then I did a little mathematics here and found that under today's production rate, it could last about 80 years. Of course, the rate will probably increase, but is that about accurate, you think?
Well, the issue, actually, the world consumes about 75 billion barrels per year. America consumes 25 to 30 of that. So they really got actually a lot less than 80. The issue, though, is not when are we going to run out of oil. We'll probably never run out of oil. We'll probably still be using oil for something 100 years from now. The issue is when do we hit the peak and thereafter for the rest of eternity essentially decline.
Okay, now why is that important? Okay. And why don't you give us your definition of peak oil?
Okay. All oil production, whether it's in an individual field, in a nation, or in the world as a whole, follows a bell curve. Now, the actual bell curve differs a little bit for each nation, but for the sake of simplicity, your listeners can just imagine a bell curve. Now, on the upslope of that bell curve, oil is a very high quality, it's very easy and inexpensive to extract. On the downslope of that curve, the oil gets very expensive and is of much lower quality.
Okay.
Now, the peak of that bell curve coincides at the point where you've used up approximately half of the oil. It's estimated that the Earth was endowed with 2 trillion barrels of oil, and we've used up, since 1850, approximately 1 trillion. Now, we'll never know for sure when we hit the peak until 3 to 5 years afterwards, because even on the upslope of the curve, oil production will sometimes drop for any number of reasons.
And is it possible that the estimate of what the total reserves might have been could be dramatically off in either direction?
It's possible, but it's looking more and more like it's less than what we've said. And in fact, the Saudi Arabia, just to use them as an example, I'll use Saudi Arabia and the United States Geological Survey. The OPEC, the amount of oil that they're allowed to export is based on what they say their reserves are. Back in the late 80s, all of the OPEC countries, that law got put in place in the late 80s, and as soon as it got put in place, all of the OPEC countries all of a sudden had their reserves just magically increased. Okay, so if Saudi Arabia says they've got 250 billion in reserves, you can pretty much bank that they have a lot less than that. Likewise, the United States Geological Survey, and this is a quote from their 2000 report on world oil reserves. Where to go?
And while you look for that, I remember doing an interview years ago with an individual who had written a book about the amount of oil possibly underneath the ocean floor, and he said there's enough oil there to last 100,000 years.
Right, Thomas Gold, the Depot Bio.
Yes.
Okay, well, I can come back to the quote from the United States Geological Survey. But basically what they say, they figure out how much, they openly admit that they cook their books. They say, we figure out how much you guys are going to use, and then we tell you that that's how much we've got. Thomas Gold, his theory is that essentially instead of oil being fossil fuels, non-renewable, that's actually a renewable resource, and it's constantly renewing itself. Now, all of the oil fields that he studied back in the 80s to produce that book are now essentially empty. If his theory was correct, United States domestic oil production would not be at 50 to 70% of what it was back when we peaked back in 1970.
That's true. It would have continued to flow.
Exactly. Now, maybe, who knows, maybe they're replenishing themselves, but at such a small rate that it's inconsequential compared
right.
to the amount that we use.
Right.
So his theory has essentially been debunked by everybody in the industry. Peak oil is accepted by essentially everybody. The only difference of opinion, some folks, most wildly optimistic estimates say we'll hit it in the year 2030. More realistic ones say that we're right on that flat part of the bell curve, that what's called the oil plateau. We've been there since the year 2000, and we're about by the year 2010, more likely 2007, we're going to go down that downslope.
And how will we really know where we are then on the curve?
Well, like I said, we know the most wildly optimistic estimates come from the United States Geological Survey, who say it's going to be about 2030. Pretty much, if you look, pretty much anybody else says it's going to happen sometime between the year 2004 and 2010. And you can look at a number of things. The energy return on energy invested in terms of how much money you're having to expend to get the oil back. You look at the estimated reserves. You look at like the fact that oil production has dropped every year since the year 2000. So it's looking more and more like we've already hit the peak. So like I said, even if the optimists are correct, we're going to hit the peak in 20 years, and that alone is an extremely serious problem.
And that comes up pretty fast. Matt, are they factoring in other countries that are beginning to develop that use oil? And, of course, China, for example, has an insatiable appetite for oil. But what about in 10 years, there's going to be other countries probably using oil more than they are now? Do they factor that in?
Well, in terms of oil production essentially mirrors oil discovery 40 years after the fact. And this is actually the gentleman who came up with the idea of peak oil. His name was M. King Hubbard. He accurately predicted that America would their oil would peak in 1970. Our domestic oil discoveries peaked in 1930. 40 years later, production peaked. What you might be confusing there is production versus consumption. So all these countries, like you mentioned, China, and this is where we're going to run into severe problems. We're heading on the downslope of the production curve, but demand keeps going up. So if you can imagine a bell curve, let's say the year of two, just for the sake of simplicity, say that the year 2000 was the peak.
Okay.
In the year 2020, oil production will be approximately what it was in 1980. Now, oil demand, though, if you were to overlay on top of that, that bell curve, more of like an L-shaped curve where it just sort of keeps going up and up and up, That's the demand level. And we're going to have 8 billion people in the year 2020, but only the amount of oil that we had for 4 billion. And because of countries like China and these other countries that are industrializing so quick, not only do we have twice as many people, but we're much more industrialized, so our thirst for oil is much greater than it ever has been before. And the further the gap between the production keeps going down, demand keeps going up, the further that gap is, the higher the price goes. So the question is not when are we going to run out of oil, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. It's when does it get so expensive that we can essentially it no longer becomes a resource.
Ah, I understand. I always thought years ago that the United States had a lot of oil, and that we were trying to use other countries, trying to deplete them first, and then we'd go back and use ours. Is that little sinister thought true, or are we truly running out?
But not that I'm aware of. Our production is down to almost 50% of what it was in 1970. So, I mean, we probably do have a good amount stored away for military usage and whatnot, but that's not anything that's going to get to you and me.
But you don't think there's this conspiratorial plan to just use up everybody else, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and then we'll have ours still left?
Well, we could, but the thing is that the government doesn't really control anything anymore. It's corporations, so
sure.
That would actually backfire, because if China's oil, we're all so tied together now that if China's oil supply went to zero, all of your consumer goods would disappear, because all of our consumer goods are produced over there. We don't even have factories anymore. So even if we had oil, it wouldn't do us much good, because we don't have the factories to make use of the oil. So the thing with government conspiracies, anything's possible, but not that I'm aware of.
And as you know, we're going to continue to drive more, not less, all over this planet. And we're going to continue then using more and more fuel. So I don't anticipate that it's going to get any lower. And what I don't see, Matt, is really anyone coming to the forefront to say, truly say, we're going to go to alternative fuel and we're going to get this done right now. And the other issue, which is very important, beyond just peak oil, of course, is this political dependence on foreign countries, for example, for us, where we need oil. I mean, that is one of our biggest problems, I think, for battles and wars. Here we are in Iraq, for whatever reason we went in, but I guarantee you, even if Iraq has its free elections in June, we're not going to leave those oil fields to them.
No.
That's my guess. What do you think?
You're absolutely correct. We actually went into Iraq. We went in there for oil. There's no doubt about it. It's not quite the way that people think. People tend to think, may have been preparing to ask this later, I don't know, but when you mentioned a moment ago driving, oil is actually crucial to our food supply. Without oil, we got no fertilizer, no plastics, no farming implements, no anything. Can't transport the food, can't do anything. So we're in Iraq not just to drive our cars, but we're in there to have gas for our cars, to be able to produce food, and to maintain our infrastructure. We're also in there because in November of 2000, Saddam switched the dollar controls oil transactions. He switched to the euro in November of 2000. That caused the euro to gain against the dollar. If OPEC had followed his lead, you would have seen a complete collapse of the U.S. economy that would have made the 1929 crash look rosy by depression. If Saddam does that, switches to the euro, you can pretty much guarantee that the U.S. is going to go in and invade and take them out as a threat to any other countries that get the bright idea that they want to nationalize their oil. And it's also sent a message to France and Germany of more or less saying don't get any bright ideas about trying to, you know, one-up the United States.
So, and regardless of what party or what group gets in the power in Iraq, I have to assume that we have troops stationed around those oil fields right now in the south and the north, and they're not leaving.
Hey, that was the first place they went when we sent them in there, were to secure the oil fields. So,
well, that's true. In the supposition is correct. You believe those troops, they may end up leaving most of Iraq, but they're not going to leave those oil fields.
Oh, absolutely.
You agree
not
with that?
Oh, yeah. We're not leaving the Middle East anytime soon. And like you said, this is not a political party thing. I mean, we were using oil for 150 years. It doesn't matter who's the president or what party's in control or whatnot. But if you want to look at what the plan is, we're going to not just be going into Iraq. We're going to be going into one way or the other, pretty much every country, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia. You already hear the saber rattling going on. If you want a step-by-step plan, go on to newamericancentury.org. It's a think tank. In 1997, they issued a proposal, or I guess you could call it, signed by pretty much everybody in the Bush administration except George Bush. He wasn't involved in it, interestingly enough. And they just flat out lay out everything that they're going to do. And it involves controlling the oil pretty much everywhere in the Middle East. And the thing is, if people really don't understand how important oil is to everything that we do, we're not going in there necessarily for greed. I mean, greed is a factor, but if we don't have enough oil, we don't have food.
Well, it's survival. It's probably greed with the corporations who are pushing this involvement.
Oh, yeah.
And it's survival for us. And I've always wondered if Americans were told exactly what's going on, if they would support that kind of intervention. And that would be, look, we have to take over oil fields. Our survival, your way of living depends on this. We have to do this. I wonder if we would support that, even as much as we continue to have our men and women dying over there every day. I wonder if we would support that kind of involvement. What do you think?
I don't know. I actually thought about a campaign that occurred to me the other day, is because our troops are over there, there's no doubt, for the oil. The world's sixth largest reserves of oil is Iraq. About 500 of our troops have died. For the powers that be, whether that's the oil companies or the government or whoever you want to say, 500 American lives is nothing for all that oil that Iraq has. And
you're not saying that. I want to make sure that's not your statement. You're not saying 500 American
lives. No, absolutely not. No, yeah. From their perspective. No, I think it's disgusting.
All right.
And in fact, my idea was like, ride your bike, save a troop. Okay, because we're out here, we're consuming. Our consumption levels are not just driving. Everything that we do, we're in the fast food restaurant, when we're driving our SUVs. You talk about supporting the troops. If you really want to support the troops, stop that. Put your SUV down and go pick up a bicycle and save yourself a troop, because they're over there not for freedom or democracy, but to support our consumption-based lifestyle.
Okay, stay with us, man. I want to talk with you more about peak oil and just really how severe that situation is. And then, of course, it's going to affect all of us worldwide. There's no doubt about that. And then what about some alternatives? How far away are we from some of those? I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Matt Savinar. Matt, the phrase peak oil, is that relatively new, or was it around years and years ago?
No, it's been around since actually the 1950s. The gentleman who came up with the term was a geologist by the name of M. King Hubbard. It's often referred to as the top of the bell curve. The peak is often referred to as Hubbard's curve after him. He, like I said before, he predicted, his first prediction was America would peak in 1970. He made that prediction I think in the 50s, and at the time he was laughed at, and he was called a doomsayer and all sorts of things, and he turned out to be correct. And pretty much in terms of peak production has more or less followed the peaking of discovery 40 years after the fact. And right now the 20% of the world's oil comes from 14 large fields. Those 14 largest fields are on average 44 years old. So we stopped discovering oil in large amounts long, long time ago, and we probably won't be discovering anymore, which means we're not going to be producing anymore.
Now, what about the oil that they have found near the Caspian Sea, for example?
Well, Caspian Sea, they thought there was going to be something like 250 to 300 billion barrels of oil. Turned out to only be about 20 to 30 billion barrels of oil. And see, there's a lot of areas such as the Caspian Sea up in Canada and a few others where there's a lot of oil there, but, the Caspian Sea, there turned out not to be a lot of oil, but in addition to there not being much oil, the oil that's there is very difficult and expensive to extract. So you may have a find where you have tons of oil, but if it's of what's called unconventional oil, something like oil sands, the cost is so high that it's essentially not a resource. Also, the problem with the Caspian Sea, if you look at all the countries around that area that they would have had to to run a pipeline through. It's just a total hotbed of you know, extremist countries, and it really would have made Iraq look like a walk in the park.
Oh, yeah.
Russia also is afraid that we're trying to muscle in on that oil. And they just had one of the largest demonstrations of their military capabilities in about 20 years. And of course, they said, "Well, this isn't to try and intimidate the United States. We're just doing this for practice." But I mean, you know, come on, we know what it's about.
Well, there's going to be a point where there will be wars fought, not just to get, but to defend over oil. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we already are. You know, people ask about, well, when are we going to deal with the ramifications of peak oil? Well, if you are in the military, or if you have a family member in the military, you've been dealing with it for 2 or 3 years now. It's also, of course, affected our economy since, you know, 2000 was probably the peak. But we're already dealing with it, and you're going to see, probably going to see the reinstitution of the draft at some point. You look, the Selective Service got a $30 million bump to its budget for the year 2005. All sorts of other activity going over there. We need oil. We're not going to conserve it. The alternatives are essentially hoaxes, and there's no way for us to get that oil without military force. So that's what the future holds for us.
All right, well, let's paint a scenario, if you would, then specifically as we peak, tell us what's going to happen.
Okay. Again, like I said, we're probably in what's called the oil plateau. Sometime between 2007, 2010, we're going to start going down the downslope. First 5 years or so, these are estimates.
And when you say downslope, are you talking about lifestyle or the oil?
Oh, I'm talking about the bell curve. Like,
okay.
Right now, we're at the very top of the bell curve, that flat part where it's flat. And we got to that point around the year 2000. The only reason we haven't had a complete collapse is that we had that recession that brought oil demand down below oil supply. Supply and demand are now in a horse race. And the way our monetary system is structured, if the energy, which we essentially get from oil, if the supply falls below demand, the whole system collapses. So right now, supply and demand are in a horse race, and they're going to stay in that horse race for anywhere between another 2 and 5 years. After that, we head down the downslope of the oil production curve. First 5 years or so after we start going down the downslope, you're going to see oil shortages reminiscent of the 1970s.
Oh, no.
Now, the thing is, with the 70s, that what happened with the oil shortages there, we peaked in 1970, and then OPEC decided they didn't want to give us their oil. Now, at that time, there were still other swing producers like Venezuela who could step in and give us oil. What the situation we're facing now is not with a political situation like you had in the 70s. You can use military might, or you can threaten, or you can do all sorts of things. Now we're at a point where the oil shortages are a geologic issue. They're an issue with the earth, and you can't threaten or negotiate with the earth to give up the oil any easier. So the oil shortages that we experienced in the 70s are going to become a continual situation.
Pretty common.
Now, the thing is, it's not going to get any better.
Okay, what would your estimate be for gasoline per gallon?
Well, gas is going to hit $3 a gallon this summer. There's no doubt about that. If you look, I live in Northern California, and if you look at if you chart it by month, like February of 2000, February of 2001. Gas has gone up $50%.
It may go up $5.
Very well. The first 5 years when we go down that slope, it's going to be reminiscent of the 70s. 5 to 15 years later, the recession of the 70s is going to turn into the depression of the 30s. 15 to about 25 years after that, the United States is going to resemble modern-day Soviet Union, who, by the way, when they collapsed, one of the reasons is that they hit their oil production peak in 1987, and under Reagan, he didn't allow them to get any additional oil from outside sources.
Now, isn't that ironic?
Then they collapsed in 1989, 2 years after the peak. Hmm. Now, the entire world now finds itself in a situation like Russia was in 1987. So, where was I? 5 to 15 years after the peak. So we're talking about you know, 10 to 20 years from now, we're going to see a second Great Depression.
And you won't be talking about $3 gasoline then.
Oh no, it's going up five. So, I mean, I wouldn't even I don't even want to venture to say, but it's going to keep going up and up and up. The thing is, it's not just gas though; it's the cost of food. Gas hits $3 a gallon, $6 a gallon, $9 a gallon. That $4 steak is going to hit $8, and then $12, and then so on and so forth. So it's going to cause everything to go up.
Well, and you could then be in a worldwide recession with that because, quite frankly, people won't be spending on other things if they're just getting by with fuel and food.
Very, very much so. And, in fact, you're going to find a lot of people who will have to make a choice. And there's a really weird catch-22. Do I put gas in my car to go to work, but then I don't have any money for food?
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't put gas in my car, I can't get to my job, which I'm already lucky to even have a job at this point. Then I can't get to my job to buy food.
Or do they say, well, here it is, it's Saturday night, I'm not going to the movies tonight because I can't afford it.
Right. Well, see, that'll be a little... I mean, I'm thinking of just, quote-unquote, the average American. I don't really know if there is an average American. But sure, first couple of years, you know, we tighten our belts. But it's a situation where you can only tighten your belt so much. And then pretty soon you're losing so much weight from not eating that you really do have to tighten your belt. You know, it's no longer a figure of speech.
What about the possibilities of riots, disturbances, massive amounts of deaths because of the stress caused by this and or wars because of this?
Very, very high. I mean, the riots and civil situations, if you want to know why the Patriot Act was passed, the real reason is that when food production, when the cost of food soars and people can't buy food, what do people do? They riot. And the only way when you have the entire population experiencing that or very, very large segments of the population, you know, you need to institute a fascist-style police state. Interestingly enough, under the category of things that make you go, John Ashcroft, when he ran for Senate in 2000, his biggest donors were two of the oil companies. I forget if it was Exxon and Mobil or Mobil and BP Amoco, and then there was another one. But they were his biggest campaign contributors, so he knows.
Of course, they're probably every politician's biggest campaign.
No doubt.
Not just him.
Yeah, no. But my point is, everybody, you know, who is in control, so to speak, they know what's going on. And if you want to know why Social Security, why Alan Greenspan just came out and said, look, he didn't say this, but he may as well have, look, you can forget about Social Security. It's because our leaders know what is going on with the oil situation. And they know that all of our money is going to be used to fight these oil wars. And this is not me saying this. I find this disgusting. But in their minds, hey, you're 65 or 70 years old. You're no longer contributing to the GNP. We have to fight all these wars to keep oil, to maintain, you know, our
lifestyle.
Exactly. Hey, you're yesterday's news. Again, I suspect that that's their mentality. Now, you could also look at it as another way. It's not necessarily evil, as they're thinking, well, we have to do what we have to do to survive, and the money has to go to the military. And they're actually, in a weird way, trying to do what's best.
Is there a way around this, Matt, or are we stuck on this path?
Well, unfortunately, the solutions that any solution is, let me put it this way, we're 30 years too late to solve the problem. There are no solutions.
Is this like coming down with cancer when you could have avoided it?
Exactly. It's sort of like, or a good example is the, for instance, we had the oil shortages in the 70s. That's sort of like...
That was a wake-up call.
Right. It's kind of like when somebody gets their first heart attack, like a mini heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor says, look, you know, sir, you've got to start doing X, Y, and Z. And if you don't, you're going to be in a really bad situation. And for a couple weeks or months, the person listens, and they do their diet and their exercise, and then they go back to their old ways, and then they find themselves in a lot of trouble. Matt Simmons, Bush's energy advisor, back in August, he was interviewed by Mike Rupert, and Rupert asked him, do you think there's a solution? And this is a quote. He goes, I don't think there is one. The solution is to pray. Under the best of circumstances, if all prayers are answered, there will be no crisis for maybe 2 years. After that, it's a certainty. Now, the problem with any solutions that we implement We can get to the so-called alternative energies, which are really hoaxes.
We'll do that next hour.
Yeah, but the foundation of any solution has to be a massive conservation program. Now, the problem with that is twofold. A, you're not going to get the government to institute sort of a mass mobilization to get people to conserve, because the industries that now control our government, agribusiness, pharmaceuticals, transportation, energy, those are the industries that would be negatively impacted by the solutions that we need to implement.
I agree. Conserving just doesn't happen. It doesn't work.
It would cause our economy to collapse. Our choice now is between a managed collapse, one that we have some control over.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like we can either choose to slow the car down voluntarily, or we're just going to drive the car or civilization straight off a cliff.
And what direction do you think we're headed?
We're going straight off the cliff, no doubt.
No stopping.
Oh, right. We're going 90 miles an hour. Right
over now. We go.
Oh, yeah.
Can it be stopped? In your opinion.
And, you know, I always try to maintain, be optimistic and be, hey, you know, we can do it, folks, and whatnot.
Rah-rah.
Yeah, but the reality is, look, we're at a point where we need to cut our consumption literally by 50%.
It's not going to happen.
And
you know that.
Oh, I know it's not. I mean, here's the real problem is that, for instance, me just trying to get the word out about the situation, I'm now on the computer 8 to 12 hours a day, whereas before I was on the computer maybe 3 hours a day. Computer uses electricity. You don't really get any electrical production without using oil. So I'm now, just by getting the word out, accelerating the collapse in a weird way.
Well, that's true, too.
You know, so it's... But there's a... So my point is there is no... Our coping mechanisms are going to be painful, but if we don't institute those, the alternative is going to be a lot more painful and actually very traumatic.
What is your motivation, Matt, to get this word out?
Well, my whole point in going to law school, I had one goal in mind, and that was to go to stop the drug war and the prison industry. And I finished school, took the bar, was temping, waiting for my bar results, and doing some work in terms of drug war abolitionist work. And then I learned about peak oil, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the biggest thing since the flood, and this threatens to dissolve our civilization. So when you have something like that in front of you, how can you not, you know, address it and try and tell people?
Ironically, I've been getting a lot of emails over the past several months about peak oil, which piqued my interest, to tell you the truth, because that's when I started looking into it, and I said, you know what, this is worthy of a program, because we've got to get the word out that there is this potential problem here, beyond man-made problems, albeit, you know, something happening to Saudi Arabia's oil fields or anything else, and as you well know, if anything happens there, we've got a real problem. And a fast one as well.
Yeah. The only thing I would disagree with you is it's no longer a potential problem. It's now accepted. The only debate is it going to hit real hard 2007?
You see, that's the optimistic part of me. I always say potential.
Yeah. Or 2017.
And that you don't know.
We don't know for sure, but it's looking more and more like we don't have but a couple of years before a real crisis hits. And this comes from folks, you know, like just quoted Simmons, Matt Simmons, Bush's energy advisor. His website, I can't remember it off the top of my head because he's got something in there that is abbreviated, like INTL. But if you just type in Matthew Simmons, he's got so much stuff on his site, and you can go on there and get it. And his credentials are bulletproof. And that's what is really troublesome is when you have an individual like that who says this is going to be worse than we could even imagine.
Well, what are the dangers of all these other countries who also use oil, who also want oil, ganging up to come and get us?
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at it this way, on my site, it's organized in a question and answer format, and most of the answers are a couple paragraphs. I have one question where I say, what's going to happen when recently industrialized China decides that it wants what little cheap oil is left, as bad as the U.S.?
Or it needs it for its own survival.
Exactly, exactly, that it needs it. That's called World War III.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. And that could happen at any time.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, we are spread all around the country in strategic areas that seem to have oil.
Yeah.
And Do you support that, by the way, or do you think we just need to just pick up, leave the oil fields alone and come home?
My own personal philosophy, now, I try to keep my own personal stuff out of the debate, although it's impossible because, you know, your own biases are going to come through. The path that we're on right now, all it does is bias a couple more years.
Okay, what's Iraq's potential? Once they get those oil fields up and running full time again, how much?
They've got $112 billion in reserve. America uses $25 billion a year, so that's about 5 or 6 years. But again, the reason we're there is not just the oil. It's not just for us to get the oil. Like, it's there for us.
That's if we used all of Iraq's oil.
Right.
You're saying.
Okay. Right. The thing, though, is we want to offset. We don't want France and Germany to get that oil. So it's like we want it, but even if we couldn't get it to our people, we want to make sure more than anything else that France and Germany and China don't get it. So even if it never comes online and finds its way to your gas tank,
right,
as long as it doesn't get into the French or German or Chinese gas tanks, that's part of what our goal is. My personal philosophy is we should be taking that $87 billion and, we need to be, whoever's in charge needs to be upfront with the people and say, look, this is the situation, A, B, and C, and take that $87 billion and start, you know, investing, conserving, and investing in the very modest solutions that we have.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those solutions when we come right back, Matt. Matt Sevenar, Peak Oil. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Matt, I don't think you're trying to spread doom and gloom. I think you're out there trying to say it the way you see it, huh?
Yeah, I was going to mention about what Terry just said. She can actually go onto my website, page 5. In the seat of the first or second question, I have a whole write-up about what's positive about this. I would say to her that, you know, and this is all going to be very difficult for us to deal with. You know, in 1976, Jimmy Carter said, look, everybody, we need to voluntarily change our ways or we're going to have a really, really bad situation when the end of the oil age hits in 2005. Excuse me, 1980, he said that. Now, Ronald Reagan said, oh, don't worry, we got oil for forever. Everything's A-okay. And then the first thing he did when he moved into the White House was take down the solar panels that Jimmy Carter put up.
I remember that.
And now you've got, and again, this is not a Republican-Democrat thing, now you have Matt Simmons, Bush's energy advisor, saying that there's no solution but to pray. And that this is going to be literally on the scale of the flood, you know, Noah's flood. There's still, as amazing as it sounds, there's still a positive about it. Just like if you get a diagnosis from the doctor that you have a serious disease, you can either say, sorry, doc, I want to hear some good news, or you can take what is admittedly a very difficult issue and try and make the best out of it. So.
Well, I had a friend, and I kid you not, Matt, because that's a good point that you just brought up, who refuses to go to a doctor because this is exactly why. He says, I'm afraid of what he'll tell me.
Well, see, that's what's going to, you know what, when you ask me about am I optimistic that we're going to change, and the thing, look, we have enough ingenuity and whatnot that it's conceivable that we could change and get out of this situation and avoid massive, massive death, to just be perfectly blunt. But then I get people who email me or seem discussing my site on the Internet, and they say, well, this is just doomsaying. And they're essentially saying what your friend said. Now, you know, my take is if somebody goes to the doctor and you get a bad diagnosis, you take that and you try and turn it into something as positive as you can. That's a true optimist. Somebody who just says, well, I don't want to hear any bad news, that's you're sticking your head in the sand.
Absolutely.
You know.
Don't kill the messenger, you know?
Oh, yeah, and that's what is going to get us killed, to be honest. It's a suicidal mindset. At this point. So,
I mean, there are people who just don't want to hear bad news.
It's one of the reasons why politicians, well, none of the Democratic candidates have mentioned peak oil except Dennis Kucinich, and one of the reasons they don't is that if they mention it and they are honest and they're honest about the limitations of the alternatives and they say, look, this is, we have a very hard road, they're not going to get elected.
No, and, I mean, they're going to say, I'm not going to vote for the guy who makes me feel bad.
Yeah.
You know?
My take on it is we're facing a crisis. Even war, you know, when Winston Churchill, when Hitler was going to invade Britain, and it looked really, things looked really, really bad
mm-hmm.
for Britain. And, you know, Winston Churchill got up there and said, hey, folks, I got nothing but blood, sweat, toil, and tears.
Yeah.
We're facing a situation even worse than that, because the fuel, the what drives our entire civilization is effectively, for all intents and purposes, gone in the next, you know, it's not actually gone, but it's going to be so expensive.
It's going to be expensive, which affects us anyway.
Right. So,
I mean, for all intents and purposes, for some people, it will be gone.
Oh, absolutely, because you drive or you eat. One or the other.
Now, is this the same situation with natural gas, which, of course, so many people in this country heat their homes with it?
Yes.
Businesses are run by it?
Yeah, there's three fossil fuels, and people tend to get the terms mixed up. And there's oil, there's gas, and there's coal. Natural gas, is got all of them have depletion profiles. Like, oil follows a bell curve. Natural gas follows what's similar to a bell curve, but it goes down. The downslope is much steeper. Now, we're set to run out of natural gas by 2020. What's going to happen is you can actually substitute natural gas for oil. So as we hit the downslope of the oil production, the oil production curve, people are going to start using natural gas more.
Well, wait a minute. We're going to run out of natural gas, you think, by 2020? That's just when I think we're going to really be in the middle of another ice age, for crying out.
Oh, it's confirmed. It's confirmed. And here's the thing, when I tell people, I say, go on my site. I have everything linked up and cited, so you can go look it up yourself. And one of the most common emails I get from people, and I've only had that site up for about 6 weeks, and I've gotten probably close to 1,000 emails. And one of the most common ones...
You'll get that by tomorrow morning.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. And one of the most common emails I get is somebody saying, you know, I went on your site, I was reading it, at first I thought you were just some crazy paranoid doomsayer. Then I started following the links. And now I think that you're either A, onto something, or B, you're speaking the complete, you know, or as true as anybody, you know, nobody's ever completely accurate. But... yeah, so natural gas is running out. Coal. A lot of people say, well, we can start substituting coal for oil, and to a certain extent, that's true. Now, there's people say, well, we've got 500 years of coal, okay, or 400 or whatever, and again, that's true. But right now, it takes one unit of coal to get out 20 units of coal.
And it's a dirty fuel, isn't
right?
it?
Right. That ratio used to be 1 to 100. You put in one unit, you get out 100. Now it's 1 to 20. By 2030. That ratio is going to be 1 to 1. When the ratio breaches 1 to 1, it's no longer a resource because you're now investing $2 to get $1 back.
Well, let's go back to natural gas for just a moment. What are we going to do to heat our homes?
We're not. No.
I mean, we can't convert back to oil, but that's going to be in trouble.
Oh yeah.
How about electricity? Electric heat.
It's all going.
That's in trouble.
Yeah. It's a very serious situation, and in fact, actually, a lot of folks think there's a natural gas, a mini natural gas crisis back in 2003, and we rely on.
Can't you say something positive and make us feel good?
We're essentially slaves right now. We don't even know it because an oil-based civilization is based on debt. Our monetary system mirrors our energy system, and our monetary system is based on growth. It came about at a time when we had an increasing supply of energy. Now, most people are either in debt as individuals, or they live in a country like the United States that is so in debt that we can't pay for our health care, we can't pay for our roads and whatnot. As the civilization collapses because we don't have any more energy, the debt-based monetary system goes with that because the two are connected.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get rid of one without getting rid of the other. I mean, because Americans have more debt than anybody, and, you know, I've got law school classmates that average graduate graduates with $90,000 in debt, so they're essentially a slave to their law firm. So the oil, the fossil fuel-based energy system collapses, the debt-based monetary system collapses, and after that, after a new, hopefully better, civilization emerges from the ashes. And one of the examples I use in terms of the mentality that we can look to is what happened when the system of slavery collapsed back in during the Civil War. For a lot of folks, that was all that they had ever known, you know, for their lives and their parents and their grandparents and so on and so forth. So when the system collapsed, it was actually really upsetting for a lot of people because they're like, well, what's going to happen to me? How am I going to eat? Who am I going to work for? And whatnot. But it also was so now they were actually afforded freedom. And that's my take on this situation is when all of this is said and done and the smoke clears, this is actually really our only opportunity to live, you know, a truly free and democratic society as opposed to something where my, folks I went to high school with are now over in Iraq so that I can drive my car 2 hours to get to my job, you know?
Christopher Marlowe wrote a book called Dr. Faustus. Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was about an individual who wanted earthly delights, wanted money, fame, you name it, that's what he wanted. But the only way he could get it, Matt, was to sell his soul to the devil. And the devil said, okay, we'll come and get it in 10 years. 10 years, you can have the time of your life, but at the end of that 10th year, your soul is mine. And, you know, by gone, he had a great time. But then when the 10 years came up, he had to give his soul up, and the devil took it away. It's sort of like that, in that a lot of us may say, well, this may be 10 years away or 20 years away. I'm not going to worry about it right now. I'm going to just continue having my life and enjoy it, and then we'll worry about it later. When the later comes, however, then we really have that problem, don't we?
Yeah, that's just going to make it that much more. If you choose to ignore it now, again, it's like ignoring a diagnosis from the doctor. It's just going to be that much more painful for you and your family and everybody around you. And you know, I think that the feedback I get from people who say things like that, it's usually from folks who have never actually experienced a collapse in their own lives. Because if you ever actually have gone hungry or anything like that, you know it's not a pleasant situation, and you'll do pretty much anything to prevent that. If you've lived a life where you've never had to worry about food and water and transportation and work and all that other type of stuff, it's not even, you don't even really have anything to compare this to. So it's almost like it doesn't exist to you. So people will be, oh, well, you know, I won't worry about it, because they can't even imagine the type of situation that we're going into.
Heck, I had a guest on this week, Matt, who believes something catastrophic is going to happen to us from space this year. So this may be a moot point. We might not have to worry about this energy problem.
Well, yeah, the thing is, I tell people, because sometimes people say, well, you know, I heard somebody on Coast to Coast and they're talking about a meteor, and you know, then there's somebody else saying that the Mayan calendar ends, and somebody else saying this. And I'm like, look, all of that may happen. I have no idea. But the thing with peak oil is this is based not on prophecy or on psychic predictions or on the Mayan calendar. Not that those things are necessarily legitimate, but this is based on hard data sourced by, you know, by geologists, petroleum engineers, people who got absolutely bulletproof credentials. This is not some, you know, psychic saying, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
You've said the alternatives are hoaxes. Why don't you explain that for me?
Well, they're hoaxes not in that they don't actually work. You know, solar panels do function, windmills do function.
Hydrogen fuel works.
Well, hydrogen's the biggest myth of them all. It's actually, oh my God, that one I could go on forever. Let me state, because there's no way we'd have time enough to go through all of them. On my site, I go through pretty much every single one of the alternatives. And you go on there, and I say, look, this is why it's not an alternative. When discussing the alternatives, you can look at them in two categories. There's shortcomings in two categories. There's economic issues, and there's ability issues. Now, the economic issue boils down to the fact that right now a barrel of oil costs $30 to $35.
Okay.
To get that the amount of energy in that barrel of oil from renewable resources, it would cost between $100 and $250.
3 to 5 times what we're paying now.
At least 3 times. Now, what that means is that an energy company is not going to be motivated to aggressively invest in renewable energy until oil hits $100, $150 a barrel. At that point, our economy is over. It's totally devastated. And what people forget is that all of the alternatives take massive amounts of oil to implement. Solar panels, for just as an example, this is true of all the alternatives. It takes a ton of oil to get the raw materials to build the solar panels. It takes more oil to build the manufacturing plant, more oil to build the solar panels, more oil to transport the solar panels to the distributor, to the retailer, and finally to your house.
Well, what about using wind power to get hydrogen power?
Well, it's the same issue. You've got to use all the oil to get the wind. Hydrogen's the biggest. Well, there's two problems.
Well, you don't need the oil for the wind.
Not for the wind, but to build the windmill, you need a massive amount of oil. You can't build when oil hits $100, $150 a barrel, and we finally get smart and think, oh wow, you know, we better start investing in renewables. It's too late. We won't be able our ability once we're motivated to invest. This is what, to be honest, when I was sitting there that one day at my computer, this is what really disturbed me, is that we won't even be motivated to aggressively invest in the renewables until it's too late.
Then we're scrambling,
yeah,
right?
We can't do it. We won't be able to even build enough windmills, even if we could. And so that's the economic issue. Then there's the issues of ability. Hydrogen is not an energy source. It's an energy carrier. You have to get the hydrogen from either solar panels or from windmills or from oil or from whatever else. It's a net loss. And that's dictated by thermodynamics.
Well, are you saying that there is no alternative energy source out there?
There's no alternative energy source that can replace oil, no. Not at all. Solar, for instance. Okay, oil, we use it, of course, to power our cars. Everybody knows that.
Unless we went into something that a lot of people don't think about, and that's the possibility of zero-point energy or possibly extracting energy from the universe, which...
Yeah.
Hasn't been fully developed.
Yeah, I've actually talked extensively with Dr. Eugene Molov of Infinite Energy Magazine.
Yes.
I had him on your show. I talked to him actually the day or two after your show. And I'm one of the biggest fans of, like, new technology. Like, I'm one of those people who's always looking at, like, discovery and things like that. But we have to look at these things honestly. We, at this point, solar power, 0.006% of our energy. Wind, 0.007% of our energy. A new energy, which is very exciting stuff, we get 0% of our energy. We don't have a functional prototype. You can't just, this is the mentality that is going to really hurt us. It's what I call the magic bullet mentality. People are, we are so much on a global scale, we're not aware of how much oil is important to us. You can't just replace oil and gas. It's impossible. You cannot retrofit a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure to solar. It just doesn't, you can't do that in 5 years. It would take, if it's even possible, it'd take 25 or 50 years, not to mention the fact that all of these alternatives we talk about, none of them can be used to produce pesticides, none of them can be used to produce fertilizers, none of them can be used to produce plastics. They can't really be used for transportation. There's some solar-powered cars, but even in terms of powering planes and boats and tanks and all the things that are important for our food supply, they're useless. Now, before I get a bunch of emails from all the solar power people, I tell people, look, if you want to get solar panels or windmills, you need to do it today, not in 6 months or a year or 2 years, because when the oil shortages really start to hit,
you want to be ready for it.
Right. Well, you're not going to. The solar panels that cost $10,000 today are going to cost $50,000.
Well, that's probably true.
And hydrogen, we could talk at length about. It's the biggest hoax of them all. Even the auto industry itself says that, look, it's way too expensive. This is a quote from this guy's the vice president of the French Energy Institute. And
are you saying, though, that we are stuck with using oil forever?
No. The alternatives, whatever civilization emerges from the collapse of an oil-based civilization, is going to have no choice but to get whatever energy it gets from these alternatives. But that civilization is going to be much, much smaller than what we have now.
So you, like so many people have predicted on this show before, you are saying that we're talking about a population right now of 6 billion people on this planet. It could go to 9. in you know, the next 10, 20 years. But you're saying that we could also expect a tremendously depopulated planet.
Yeah, if you look at any species, whether it's bacteria, whether it's reindeer, whether it's human beings, when you give them resources, their population, if you chart it out, it follows an L curve where it's flat at the bottom and it shoots straight up. Again, it's true for every species.
So this secret report that the CIA has, by the way, that we can expect ice ages, calamities because of weather, energy problems and shortages, this is real stuff. Stay with us. Matt Sevenar, my guest, will be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. No, not all doom and gloom. We're going to try to find a solution here before you're done with him. Matt, tell us about some other emerging technologies, thermal depolymerization. How does that work?
Right. Thermal depolymerization is this technology. It was first got into the public's mind about a year ago when it was profiled in Discovery magazine. It's really, really neat stuff. Essentially, what you do, you can put in almost anything, like from tires to turkey guts to whatever. You put it into the machine, and you get oil out as a result.
Hmm.
And I cover it on my site, and the site's, you know, got a lot of stuff on there, so people tend to overlook some things. And I still get emails, people saying, well, you know, we don't have any problems because we have thermal depolymerization, we're saved. There's a couple problems with thermal depolymerization, just like there's problems with all of the alternatives that we have. Now, I think it's fantastic technology, and if I had, you know, $20 million to throw around, I'd be throwing some money at thermal depolymerization.
You would? You would try it out?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we need more. Here's what makes me the least optimistic, or makes me nervous, or even more nervous about our situation, is people read the article in Discover, which is not a peer-reviewed journal, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they go, oh, look, we're saved. No oil problems. They're just going to, the smart people in Washington or the smart scientists are going to come up with something. Okay, thermal depolymerization, the stuff that goes into it, tires. Where do you get tires from?
And by the way, they could have come up with a word we could all pronounce, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I call it for short trash into gas.
I'm going to start calling it just thermal depol, and that's it.
Yeah, I go trash into gas. I try TD, but that, you know, people get the letters mixed up. But it's really great stuff. You put the tires in or the turkey guts, and out comes oil. But where are tires? Tires come from oil themselves. So you're feeding, it's like you need oil to get the stuff that you're sticking into the machine. And the second law of thermodynamics dictates that whatever comes out is going to have less energy than whatever goes in.
Of course.
So and right now there's only one thermal depolymerization plant. We need thousands of them. What it can do, like I was saying earlier, we are 40 years, 30 years past being able to solve this. The best we can do, and this is with all the optimism in the world, is have a managed crash.
Right, we can lessen the blow.
Exactly, and technology like thermal depolymerization, it can help us as we lose oil, can help us maintain a higher energy efficiency as we go down that downslope. But what disturbs me the most is I get emails from people saying, what are you worrying about? We're saved. We have this new technology. And I'm like, it's not that simple. You don't just invent something or make a discovery and replace oil. It's like if all you eat is corn, you know, and your crop is about to be wiped out, and you're like, well, I've got one apple tree that I just started growing, I'm saved. No, you don't replace something that is this intrinsic to our civilization. It's not that simple.
But do the big oil companies do about this, Matt? I mean, are they sitting back laughing, going, ha-ha, we've got them? Or are they really working on some kind of alternative plan here?
Well, their alternative is to downsize and merge. They've been having all these downsizing and all these mergers, and that's what you do when you look at their actions, and they're the actions of people who are planning a profitable decline. And I even have on the site, I have a question, well, what are the oil companies doing to solve this? And I go through the whole list.
They'll make more money doing less, won't they?
Yeah, actually, the more severe the collapse is, the more money they're going to make.
Yes.
Because if you have a, let's say it takes $10 to refine, I'm just throwing out the numbers to make them simple. Let's say it takes $10 to refine and extract a barrel of oil, the $10 in February of 2004. And right now you sell it for $30 or $35, okay? A really severe collapse happens, oil gets really scarce, you can sell that now for $100 or $150. And the thing is, it's not that the oil companies are evil, okay? I know everybody's out there thinking, oh, my God, yes, they are. It's a combination of things. The law says that when you're a CEO, this is the law, that when you're a CEO or a corporate officer, you have to do what is best for the company, not for the world, not for yourself, that's self-dealing, not for God or nature or whoever else.
Shareholder value, they call it.
Exactly. And like I was saying before, you would need renewable energy. It takes five times as much, you know, to get that energy that you would get from a barrel of oil. So if you're a CEO and you think to yourself, oh, goodness, we're about to drive our civilization off a cliff, we should invest aggressively in renewable energy, you can't do that because that's not your job. Is for the company, not for humanity, and the law prevents you from doing that. And if you want to save the world, quit your job and you know, go do something else.
Well, what about the human factor, though? I mean, just look at what's going on in Haiti, where they believe Aristide is not helping the poor and that he's been up to some shenanigans. These people are going crazy. Multiply that times 300 or 400 million people that we could have just in this country in the next few years.
We have all the elements for a complete meltdown. We're going to have gas shortages. We're going to have food shortages. We're going to have water shortages. We have large gaps between the rich and the poor. We have a very diverse nation. We're very politically, I forget what the word is, when you're, everybody swung way to the left or way to the right. So we have a military that I think is beginning to, I have the book I'm working on, I've got some quotes from, I don't remember his name, but he's really very well known in the military community. And he says, look, the troops know what's going on. They know that they're not fighting for the American flag. The flag they're fighting for has BP or Exxon. You know, and they know this. These are actually very good critical thinkers, and they're getting a little bit upset that they're being treated the way they're being treated. And we send them over there without bulletproof vests, the National Guards and the Reserve. So there's also, we've got all the factors I just mentioned. Plus we have a military that is getting understandably and justifiably very upset at the way they're being treated. So we have all the elements of a meltdown. So.
Technologies of the Tesla could have helped us a long time ago, and I don't see that really being developed right now. Do you envision anybody being just so novel and so futuristic that they'll come up with something and bypass the potential problem?
Well, here's the problem, and I addressed that on the site. I have a question that says, well, wait a minute, we're really inventive. What if some genius comes and invents something?
Yeah. Okay.
How are you going to mass produce that without oil, without cheap oil?
Don't know. I can't answer that.
You can't. Have you considered the fact, and this is not me asking you this, this is just me asking everybody who figures, well, some genius is going to think of something, you know, the next Nikola Tesla. How are you going to mass produce it? Is it going to happen before billions of people die or after? Okay. Have you considered the fact that you've got multi-trillion-dollar energy companies? Because whoever gets something like that is going to make a lot of money. They've been investing in trying to find something, some alternatives, for years with no success. Have you considered the fact that even if you invent that, that solution will cause a collapse in of itself? If you came up with a device tomorrow that you could just plug onto your car and you never have to use gas or anything else. I know you had a guest, Bob Lazar, on last night, and I can address some of the deficiencies in his device that he didn't mention or whatnot. But let's say you invented some device like that. How many industries, if they even allow you to come up with it, if the U.S. Patent Office even allows you to put a patent on it, how many industries are going to be wiped out? Our whole stock market is based in like transportation and agriculture and all these industries that are oil-based. So if you invent some device that replaces oil, which you essentially cannot.
Then let's say you create a free energy device, okay?
So that's the thing. If there's no profit in it, nobody's going to do it.
I agree with that. It's unfortunate, but you're absolutely right. Even if there could be alien technology that we have that could give us an abundance of energy at minimal cost, I don't see a motivation today to give it to us.
The other problem with that is it just puts off the problem even longer, because then let's say, and again, I want to emphasize this, you cannot just replace oil, okay? And if you really want to see why, go onto my site and I cover every reason why you can't use it. It's just not that simple.
No, but you might be able to minimize its use.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's say you created a device like that, and it allowed us to the oil that we're using to drive our cars, we could use to keep up the food production. Well, the population would continue to grow just like it does in every species when they have enough food, and we would just put off the crash until another resource.
Here's an example. With some states, you might be able to put up solar panels on your own home, create some of your own electricity to last you a year, and that excess electricity can be stored in batteries and sent back down the grid, and other people could use it. You could actually get a discount from using electrical power. If everybody could do that now, with the cost of the solar panels, as you said, at a lower level than they would be in 10 or 20 years, at least for some portions of our existence, we'd be well on our way. I mean,
well, see, this is the problem. Somebody yesterday asked me a similar question. I said, we're using up X amount of oil right now. If everybody goes out and buys solar panels, it takes oil to manufacture those, which means we're going to increase our demand for oil by everybody going out and buying solar panels, which will actually accelerate the situation. The only way that's going to work is if we'd have to cut our consumption of everything else and then replace, let's say we're consuming stuff on fast food, because fast food is very much oil powered. We cut out the fast food and we invest in solar panels. Okay, we'd still only have about 5 years. Okay, because that's really the maximum amount of cheap oil that we have left. And so I tell people, if I owned my own home and I had the money to put solar panels up, I'd do it tomorrow. But in terms of the thing that is our problem is people think, well, if we just do this or this or this, it's solved and we can go, we don't have to think about it. But the solutions require a massive amount of oil that we're not going to have. And if we've waited so long now that we find ourselves in a catch-22 of just devastating proportions, because we can't even do something like that without accelerating the timetable.
Do you see a way out at all for us?
No, well, painless way? No.
A painless way.
No, there's no painless way, because any part of the solution is going to require, or I should say the coping mechanism, is going to require a massive conservation effort.
But it's not going to happen. You know that as well as I do, we will not conserve. The only way we conserve is if we're out of it.
Yeah.
That's the only way it's going to happen.
So there's no solution that doesn't require that, but even a massive conservation program is going to be very painful because we also need to reduce our population in a humane way. Between that and, reducing how much we consume, that could go a long ways to solve it, but look at the problems that even that solution creates. Because if we voluntarily reduce our population, that means there's less young people to be in the workforce, which means that the people who are entering retirement, aren't going to have anybody to support them.
It's also a domino effect. If you start doing this, then you set a mindset where people don't buy cars. And, I mean, once they stop buying cars, they're going to also stop buying houses.
Yeah.
Once they stop buying houses, they're going to stop buying clothes, and I mean, and furniture, and I mean, it's just going to be one thing after another, isn't it?
The thing is, that's what is so difficult about our situation, is that the solutions in of themselves are one that no politician can get up and say that, because it's going to cause the economy to collapse. But it's now a choice between a collapse where you have it's just total chaos and total anarchy, or a collapse that we can at least control and we can at least hopefully maintain a basic food supply and water supply and not de-evolve into some horrible Mad Max existence. But to prevent that, we have to do things that we are incredibly reluctant to do. So I'm optimistic. I say to people, if you're thinking that, there's a way to save the whole civilization, I'm not very optimistic about that. That doesn't mean that you can't be optimistic about your own self and your own community. Like, there are certain small communities that, are beginning to take this seriously. But if you're thinking that there's going to be some, mass, nationwide mobilization effort, forget it. It's not going to happen.
So maybe Simmons' idea and approach of prayer.
Well, no,
maybe
absolutely.
That works.
I say to people, it's one of those things, you know, not so much from a religious aspect, but when you start appealing to higher consciousness, when you start asking your own subconscious for questions, there's a story of a, well, I won't use that story on the air, but it's amazing what you can do when you start asking your subconscious questions. You can get out of what are essentially hellish situations.
See, I think if you take the positive in this, and you begin to tap into the might of people, not the greed, but the might, that it might solve itself. The problem is it could very well be a battle, Matt, between good and evil in such a way that, you know, the good are the people of this planet who want to help and get things done. The evil would be those that want to continue to extract and profit and do whatever they need to do because they don't care.
Yeah.
You know, those people who end up making so much money out of all this,
yeah,
they're gonna still have their oil, right? They're gonna still eat.
Oh, yeah. The folks who are, see, that's people, one of the things that people say, they're like, well, wait a minute, all the powers that be, you know, the oil executives and these people, if everything collapses, doesn't it collapse for them? And I'm like, no, because they're at the top of the scale, so to speak. They can still be at the top of the scale with 500 million people on the planet, particularly with the, you know, advances in technology. They don't need a huge population to maintain the lifestyle that they currently
have. Could this be a plan for control, population control?
I look at it this way. You know, there's certain things that we have hard evidence to back up, okay? Things like population control, there's a lot of really good circumstantial evidence.
We could be being duped into thinking all these other things are happening in order to satisfy this control hunger that this group might have, if one believes in the Illuminati and a one-world government theory.
My belief is this, that, okay, oil depletion is very much a reality. Now, the Illuminati or the power to be or whoever it is, they're, of course, going to use this, any crisis that arises, they're going to use it to their benefit.
Well, case in point. Saddam Hussein was a butcher. He hated humanity except his own group, and he killed off millions of people in Iraq. There's no question he had to go. The question is did we use that purpose to create a mechanism to go and get the oil and do what we wanted to do? Did we use that as a framework, the weapons of mass destruction, for example, as an excuse to really get to the final destiny, and that was to control the oil? Now, the same thing you could say would be about the population control worldwide. Are they creating something out of a real problem that's there? As you just said, the oil problem is a real problem. But are they saying, now we can do what we need to do?
I mean, through, like, tricking us to thinking that, by getting us, like, to voluntarily reduce our population, or...
Just the control factor, because once you control, you can just about do anything. You can control the food supply. You can control the energy supply. And if this plan is indeed to reduce, as I believe, a worldwide population from 6 billion down to what so many people have theorized to be 500 million total, what a way to do it, Matt.
What are we to do to combat that?
We can't, can we?
I'm not so sure about that. I look at the all these different people as sort of like bank robbers or gangs who are competing. They're not as unified as we may be intimidated, as we may be fearful. They instill fear in us, much like if you look at a plantation, you got 300 folks on the plantation and 3 or 4 people overseeing them. There's nothing actually keeping them from breaking free other than the mentality of fear that has been instilled now in all of us. I lost my train of thought again.
But there is this one world government push out there.
Yeah, I do think there may very well be population reduction programs. I think some of the diseases that we see emerging are SARS and whatnot, AIDS. There's a genetic aspects to them. There's bioeconomic aspects to them.
So I'm saying, look at what you've just presented to us, and magnify it. because it could be a very real reason why they need to continue to accomplish their own missions, their own goals. Stay with us, Matt. When we come right back at the top of the hour on Coast to Coast in this very fast program, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to chat with Matt Sabinar. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. So, Matt, as far as known world oil reserves, number one would be what, Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to name and rank the six top, but Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, I think Syria, and then now they consider reserves. See, there's all sorts of different, you ask different people and you get a different definition of reserves.
Right. Okay.
Now they've included like Canada, the oil up in Canada in terms of reserves, and that bumped Canada way up to the very top. But that's oil, it has such a low energy return on energy invested that they basically cook the books so that you and I are duped into thinking there's not a real problem. As an example, they'll often say, well, don't worry, we got 80 years oil left at current rates, not mentioning that the rates are always going up. So right there, you knock that number down to 40, and then they don't mention that after, say, 10 years, or, you know, again, I'm oversimplifying the situation here, they don't mention that after a few years, it's going to take 2 gallons of oil to get out 1 gallon of oil, which means that there might be 20 years in the ground, but it does us no good. So,
or what about Venezuela? Where do
Venezuela's got a good amount. Colombia, West Africa actually has a pretty decent amount. Any country you hear in the news, for whatever reason, they've got oil.
See, we're having problems with Venezuela now.
Yeah.
The president thinks we're out to get him. I mean, are we systematically then going after these known oil reserves?
Oh,
do you see this happening?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, two of the most fascinating articles that anybody can read, and one of them I should have linked to on my site, but I haven't, and I will. On FromTheWilderness.com, their energy editor, a man by the name of Dale Allen Pfeiffer, I don't know if I was pronouncing his last name correct, he did an analysis where he looked at, and he's got the graphs, so you can see what a oil production curve looks like. It's not a perfect bell curve. It's a roughly shaped bell curve. But you can go on there, onto the site, and look at this article. I'll link to it on my site at some point in the next few days. And he predicts what countries we're gonna either invade, either with actual military force, or we're going to quasi-invade them through, like, economic and, you know, through other stuff, based on when they hit their peak. So countries like any country that is a target on the war on terror or the war on drugs, they've all got oil reserves. It even turned out Liberia. Remember how you were hearing about Liberia in the news?
Sure.
Yeah, they got some oil under there.
Okay, that's going to be interesting to watch then. I'm going to watch for that specifically.
One more thing. One of the first people who was prominent, at least outside of the geology community, talking about peak oil was a man by the name of Jay Hansen, who has a site called dieoff.org. And that was one of the first sites that now the folks in the peak oil community, like Richard Heinberg, who wrote a book, The Party's Over, he got started by reading Jay Hansen's stuff. And there's an article Jay Hansen has on there, written in like 1996 or 97, and he flat out, he goes, look, this is what's going to happen. We're going to hit the plateau starting around 2000, 2001, and then you're going to see whoever's president say, hey, we got to go take out Saddam, and you're going to see us occupy Iraq. And that was written back in 96. Based on looking at the peak production curves, I'll put it this way, George, you know, you could probably make a living as being a psychic in terms of predicting geopolitical events just by looking at a nation's oil production curve.
Good point. Let's go to the phones as promised. Wildcard line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Matt Sabinar. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure thing.
I have just a quick statement to say for Mr. Sabinar. It sounds to me like he's got a lot of problems and no solutions, and it seems like everybody on the whole planet pretty much has that. So I wanted to just call in real quick and just let everybody know that there is a solution and there is an inventor, and he's from Canada. I won't use his name or the company that he's from or his website or anything, but they have devised a way to produce hydrogen chemically from combining, if you think of the movie Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and, you know, when the plates kind of slam down into the ice and the gases are given off, Okay, well, that process is kind of similar to the type process that he's devised, to where they're able, when the plates are actually slammed down into water or salt water, then it uses the stored energy in the metal, the potential energy there, to combine chemically to allow the hydrogen to be given off. So therefore, it doesn't necessarily follow, like he said, the law of thermodynamics is what keeps hydrogen from being a producer rather than just a carrier.
Right. Now, do they use oil at all in this process to do what they have to do?
Well, if you want to say that a factory takes oil, then yeah, I guess just if every factory, therefore, demands that we use oil, then yeah, I guess there probably would be in some of the trucks to ship it to people's houses. But let me put it to you this way, George. If you slam them plate, if you put that thing onto a car and it, you just make the plate larger for more hydrogen, you make the plate smaller for small amounts of hydrogen, and what it does, the whole gist of the whole thing is that it bypasses that second law of thermodynamics by allowing you to get more hydrogen out because of the chemical reaction. See, everybody thinks it's all about the chemical reaction. There's another guy that's from Blacklight Power that, you know, he may have solved the whole Einstein theory of relativity.
Yes, exactly.
And I heard just a couple weeks ago you had the guy on, I can't remember his name. I think Mr. Savinor had mentioned that he speaks with him some.
Eugene Malov.
Eugene Malov, that's it, yeah. He had said that he thought that was kind of a cold fusion type thing, and it's actually not. What it is, it's just a chemical reaction. See, chemical reactions bypass those laws by using the stored energies in the chemicals that are actually there. So if you can mine this stuff up, which does take oil, go ahead and say that, then you've got, you know, you, if say you run your mining equipment on fuel cells on hydrogen, then there you go. It's a completely limitless process. So the guy that's a genius is named Blaine Broats, and he's a genius, and he's developed that process, and they're developing in Tennessee right now. It's my home state. They have the very first production facility for it, and they're going to commercialize it by the end of this year. So I'm terribly excited about it because it's in my home state, and they're from Canada, and he's going to basically prove Mr. Savinor wrong and the oil companies wrong in every way.
Well, you know,
by the end of 2004.
Those are the kinds of people, Matt, that we need in order to solve part of this dilemma.
The thing that I didn't catch the caller's name, but you can go onto the fifth page of my website, and I have a whole list of solutions. You got to identify the problem and the true scope of the problem before you can address these solutions. Now, it's not proving me wrong. I said earlier, if I had $20 million, I'd be throwing money at Dr. Eugene Malov like there's no tomorrow, and because literally there may not be a tomorrow. So we absolutely have to invest in these technologies. I think I have a question on page 3. Of the website that I would encourage the reader and other individuals to go ask themselves, how quickly can that invention be, assuming it is actually commercially viable, okay, and I'll go ahead and say, let's just go for the sake of argument, you know,
sure.
I'll presume that it is, how quickly can it be scaled up from an experimental prototype model to a mass production? Has he addressed the fact that hydrogen, which is the smallest element, will leak out of almost any container? Completely underestimating how much oil it takes to build a factory, to build a car. It takes as much oil to build a car as that car consumes in the time that it's driven. So these are absolutely fantastic technologies. I want them to come online quicker and better than anybody, but we have to be realistic. There is not a magic bullet. And if we're going to just sit back as individuals and think, well, hey, there's some folks who've got these really cool technologies that are not functionally, they're in the prototype stage, and maybe in 10 or 15 years we can start mass producing them. If we just sit back and think, oh, great, hey, some genius solved it, that is what is going to get us knocked down. I actually share that listener's enthusiasm for this type of stuff, and I've even talked with Dr. Malov about trying to get funding for his foundation. But we have to be honest. We look at these things with an honest eye in terms of their ability to replace oil and replace oil quickly.
Okay, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Thanks for that response, Matt, by the way. Hello there. You are on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've got a couple questions and a comment.
Okay.
I bought a farm that's got 3 gas wells on it. And I figure that I use a barrel of oil a day. And I'm trying to completely get away from, I don't know what you want to call it, these oil barons that I think that we should quit giving all these Middle Eastern companies our countries our wheat and stuff, and use that and let them eat their oil and see how powerful they are.
Yeah, well, one would think that there'd be a way to negotiate where everybody wins, you know that?
Well, the thing is we pay through the nose for their oil, and then we give them grain and stuff, and we're spending our money to buy their oil to produce grain that we give them.
That's the humanitarian part of the United States.
But what I'm trying to do is get completely off the grid and quit using Middle Eastern oil, and I don't know how to do it because somebody else controls my oil wells, or my gas wells,
mm-hmm.
oil. I have gas. And
do you mean? You lease them out?
Well, they were leased before I bought the
thing. Yeah, and I mean, they've got leases for like a zillion years, don't they?
Well, they figure that the production of these is going to be 10 years, but I have unlimited free natural gas off of the wells.
What do they pay you, by the way? I'm curious, to lease those wells or the land?
I get $25 a month off of each one of them, roughly.
And what do they make per
month?
About
$1,500.
They make $1,500 a month, and you get $25, and it's your gas, basically.
I get 0.8%.
Gosh. I don't know. Have you tried solar panels?
Well, I want to do everything. We're building a wind generator right now because we're in a windy spot.
I'm sorry, listener, I didn't get you. What's your name again? I'm sorry.
Brian.
See, now, Brian's got the right idea because there's so many of us, we've become so apathetic that we're just waiting for some genius or some government agency to fix this for us. Folks like Brian are the ones who are going to live through the collapse and see whatever type of civilization emerges, because he's taking the situation. He's not waiting for some national or federal program. He's taking control of the situation, and he's doing what he can for himself and his family, if you have one, sir, and doing, you know, for him, essentially the American way, which is rugged individualism. You're going to have to fend for yourself, and that's what he's doing, and he's going to probably make it, while a lot of us aren't. So,
but well, what can I do to get off the grid?
Well, it looks like from what you're saying, you know, in terms of trying to build solar panels and windmills, those are probably the two best things you can do.
You know, you get a battery storage unit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's out there.
Yeah.
If I was able to,
I'd tell people, look, I'd buy a home. You know, not out in the middle of nowhere, but not exactly in the middle of Chicago or L.A. or anywhere. And I'd get it. I'd get exactly what Dick Cheney, George Bush, and Al Gore all have, which are their homes are completely solar powered, and it's completely off the grid. And you know, they got the whole, it's an environmentalist dream, essentially. So, but it sounds like the listener is already on that path.
Well, what's it cost, do you think, to have your home solar powered with battery chargers? I think Gene was telling us it was $4,000 to $6,000 a house. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Are you asking me or the listener?
No, you.
Yeah, I was under the impression it was 10. I have actually not looked into it myself because I'm not at the point that I could afford that.
So if somebody spends $100 a month, let's say, for electricity, $1,200 a year,
yeah.
You're talking 8 or 9 years out there. It's going to take a very special mindset in order to make that kind of an investment to recoup it after 8 or 9 years, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a type of mindset that we are very much a short-term mindset. So it's one that is we don't necessarily come by, an everyday experience. But folks who are willing to do that, they're going to be at the very least, just in the short term, as we get natural gas, more natural gas shortages, as we get more blackouts like what we had back in like August, which is just going to become more and more prevalent. The folks like Brian who are moving off the grid are. They're going to be much better situated,
mm-hmm.
than just about everybody else.
Let me suggest also to you, Brian, go to my website under show information, which is on the left-hand side of the homepage. If you get into that and then get into guests, look for Eugene, Mallove, and he's got some nice reading material there for you that would help you get off the grid. First-time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Dan from Riverside.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy your show. I listen to it just about every day.
Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
I think there is a solution, and I think it's going to require every individual, at least in this country, to get it in motion. I drive a truck now for a couple of years, and there's a lot of land here we don't use. They're building more homes around here than I can shake a stick at, and I don't know where these people work. I hate to drive, as a matter of fact. But my thing is we need to develop the natural resources. Now, I think technology is destroying the human race. If you would look at the history of the last 1,000 years at all, the human race was not ever on the verge of extinction. And I'm willing to, when the gas went up in the 70s, I rode my bike for 6 months. And if I had to move to get closer to work in order to do that, I did that.
Yeah, but you're rare. You're rare. Not a lot of people would do that. That's my take, at least.
But that's what, I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take every individual to say, I don't need a Mercedes, and I don't need to drive that 2 hours into L.A. because I like to live out here where it's a little rural,
yeah.
And da-da-da-da-da. I go up and down the Interstate 5 to Seattle. I cut across Washington, go to Montana, come back to California, and there's a lot of land out there. And, so we might have to cut some wood for a while and grow some more trees and come up with some other things, you know, but you look at technology, and it's been a very, 100 years, and we're about ready to destroy the human race.
So how many people, Matt, do you think realistically could do what Dan just suggested, which is a good idea, but how many people can really do that?
Oh, well, it's difficult. You know, people always ask me what preparations I'm making, and I'm like, look, I finished school not long ago, and it's from a financial standpoint, it's very difficult. My advice to people is I've got a list of steps on the site, and I say go through this and start small. You can do whatever you can given your current means. The truth is most people in America are so much in debt that they can't, just up and move and take another job. You know, that's the only job they have. They don't know if they're going to find another one, so they may not have the ability to move closer to where they live.
We should get mandated tax credits, for example, on everything we spend, like solar panels and battery chargers and stores and everything like that. We should be able to get almost 100% write-off.
It should be combined with some type of patriotism, because the more we do stuff like that, the more we can get our troops back home,
And there should be a national financing program for people. You know, you want to fully put the solar panels on your house and pour power back on the grid for other people. They should be able to work out a loan program for everybody. And I think that would work. Matt, we'll be back with you in just a moment. We'll continue to take phone calls for the rest of this hour. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Matt, what are the possibilities of using ethanol, which is a derivative from corn, or possibly hemp for fuel?
Well, hemp would be, of all the possible biomass fuels, hemp would be the best. It's not a coincidence. Ethanol only exists because it's subsidized by cheap oil. It's not a coincidence. Ethanol takes $1.71 of fossil fuels to create a dollar of ethanol. And the only reason ethanol even exists is the company that produces the corn, 60% of the corn in the Midwest, throws a ton of money at Congress, so voila, you have ethanol. Here's a problem with biomass in general. By 2050, we're going to have, at the rate we're going, we're only going to have enough, we're going to have 520 million people in the United States, only 290 acres of arable land. That's only 0.6 acres per person. You need for a sufficient diet a minimum of 1.2 acres. So we're only going to have enough land to feed half of our population. We're not going to have any land.
And we've been feeding now half of the world, right?
Not as much as that's something that we don't export as much as people think. But as we continue, as our population continues to grow, as the soil continues to erode, from all the things that we're doing, we won't be able to have any spare land left to grow biomass. If you were going to pick one plant, it would be hemp. Hemp is by far the most efficient. It's got so many great things about it. The reason marijuana was outlawed and therefore hemp was essentially outlawed is we used to use it for everything that we use plastic for now. In fact, the founding fathers, it was a requirement back in those days that you grew a lot of hemp. Then DuPont came out with plastic. Plastic is an invention, so you can patent it. Hemp, you can't patent.
Hemp was also being used for paper goods.
Hemp is like the most versatile thing out there.
Yes.
So DuPont was politically in bed with the Hearst family, and so they launched a public relations campaign.
Who owned forestries everywhere, right?
Right. They owned all the newspapers, or many of the newspapers. So they launched this whole program saying, "Oh my God, marijuana is evil, hemp is evil," and then it got outlawed in 1937, and then plastics became dominant, and then, of course, plastics come from oil, so this is all sort of tied together, and now we have the war on drugs. Anytime we declare a war on something, war on terror, war on drugs, it's a cover operation for something probably much more sinister.
And there's money behind it.
Absolutely.
Always
the war on drugs is just a money maker for all sorts of.
I mean, that's a whole other show.
But it does tie into the hemp and the oil.
And since some people emailing me saying, "Tell Matt we've got enough oil on this planet." You're not saying we're running out of oil
today.
No,
I've said this a million times. I'll continue to say it. We will probably be using oil 100 years from now. It's not a matter of running out of oil per se. There's tons. There is literally tons and tons and tons of oil up in Canada and up in other areas. It's a matter of energy return on energy invested.
At what cost, who controls it, and how do we get it?
Right. Oil used to be you could invest $1 and you'd get $100 back.
Mm-hmm.
That, as we moved up that bell curve, that ratio has gone down and down and down and down. Now, on average, like the oil we get from the Middle East and from other places, you invest $1, you get $10 back. So if I put out a dollar and I got $10 back, I can go feed myself pretty well, okay? Right. If I go invest, like up in Canada, the oil up there, you have to invest a dollar to get $1.50 back. I can't go really buy any with that ratio.
You can't make any money.
Exactly. And if you're dropping from a ratio of 10 to 1 to 1.5 to 1, that's disastrous for the economy. So there's tons of oil there, but now that we're on the downslope, it's of much lower quality and it's much more expensive to produce.
Off to the phones we go. Wild Card Line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
I guess that's me.
It is you.
Diana from Russell, Kansas.
Hi, Diana. Go ahead.
Oh, first time I got on, I'm so happy. I really, this is a great, insightful show tonight. I'm pretty frugal by nature, so I'm kind of a survivalist person. And I just wanted to ask your guest speaker there, Matt, what do you think about, like the energy for like a small home if you don't really have the money to do this solar? What else could we do for our heating and all this?
You could go the old-fashioned way, and if you have a fireplace or something of that nature.
Yeah, that's on my list.
Yeah. What I tell people, one of the first things to do, just in general, is sounds like you're already on this path, is try to reduce your consumption as much as possible. And then you can invest in whatever limited alternatives you can scrounge up. Unfortunately, I'm not really an expert in preparation.
Mm-hmm.
What I've done is I've taken peak oil and I've approached it in much the same way I would approach a life or death case, trying to get back a verdict from a jury to say, yes, we have a serious problem and we need to start taking serious action. I'm not necessarily the best person to go to in terms of, what type of solar panels or what, all that type of stuff. But, you can go online and there's tons of sources. One recommendation I might make, get The Party's Over by Richard Heinberg. It is the most thorough and easy to access book out there on the oil situation, and he's got a lot of recommendations in terms of preparations that you can begin making.
Great, so, thank you.
Okay, good luck to you.
All
thanks
right.
for calling. I'm glad you got through. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with Matt Savinar. Hi there.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. I'd like to ask the guest tonight about the issue of perpetual motion as a possible alternative energy solution. I'd like to suggest, actually, that the construction of a perpetual motion machine based on specifically the use of magnetic and even gravitational force to supply the drive is logical. It's logical that can be achieved. If you consider magnetism and gravity, they're actually in and of themselves perpetual motion systems in that they provide a source of constant power and energy. And basically, it's free energy to be taken advantage of. And just as early mills were powered by, rivers and streams, it seems like someone could you know, utilize gravity or magnetism to translate that into a working device. From what I understand, there have been recent attempts at using magnetism to power perpetual motion machines, and I've heard that there's at least one company that apparently they build these magnetically powered perpetual motion motors.
Well, I don't think anybody really has any of these motors yet that are ready to run. Matt, have you heard about this one?
No, I haven't. The questions I would ask him are the same questions I asked to some of the other listeners with what I call, I guess you could call that in the category of new energy versus alternative energy.
One idea, I just want to throw this one idea too. Just as there are solar panels that are designed to convert solar radiation into usable energy, I wonder why, I don't know quite enough information about this, I guess, but I wonder why it has... It hasn't been looked into like there, as though you could harness magnetic radiation into some similar technology such as our solar panels. You might have magnetic panels or whatever that could utilize.
The problem with any of these technologies is, no matter, you have to look into what the energy return on if you're going to try and come up with a solution or a coping mechanism, you have to look into energy return on energy invested. Oil has always had, and still, does to this day, has a fantastic amount of energy return on energy invested. It used to be such a great return that it essentially was free energy. Oil, for instance, in Texas, used to be cheaper than water. So these devices and these new emerging technologies, which, for lack of a better word, I'd call new energy, as opposed to the traditional alternatives, you have to ask these questions like, how much... in terms of dealing with the oil crisis that we're going to, long-term oil crisis we're approaching, how long does it take to move from a theoretical or perhaps even an experimental scale device to a mass production? Can this device be adapted to our current infrastructure? So these ideas like perpetual motion and vacuum energy and zero point cold fusion, we definitely need to be looking into these, but you have to ask yourself, can you retrofit a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure for the device that this gentleman's talking about? I mean, can you do that in the next 5 years? Okay? I don't think that the answer is yes. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking into these things, because when you have a situation as desperate as the one that we find ourselves in, you need to be looking at every possible alternative and every possible coping mechanism. But again, I ask the listener and anybody else thinking the same thing, go on to page 3 of the site. At the bottom of the page, I have a long list of questions. Ask yourself those questions about any of these new emerging technologies.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with Matt Savinar. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, gentlemen?
We're doing fine, thank you.
Great. My comment has to do with setting up my question here. I mean, I remember back in the early 80s when they were building... the nuclear power plant down by San Luis Obispo and all the protesting that went on while they were building it. And I believe it was up and running when they had their power crisis, wasn't it? Because if it wasn't, then they would have really been in a big world of hurt.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yes, and but I was wondering, let's just say in the next 5 or 6 years, all of a sudden every state had one nuclear power plant built, because that was old technology back in the early 80s. Now, GE and other companies, I'm sure, around the world have built very efficient nuclear power plants. How many years could we tack on to the oil if we just, I know nuclear power plants can't build plastics and stuff, but it could save a lot of oil in other ways.
Well, actually, and just for everybody else, page 2, I deal with nuclear on my site. There's a couple problems. We would need to manage to make up, putting aside the huge issues of radioactivity and nuclear waste and the possibility of terrorism, over the next 20 to 40 years, we would need an additional 800 to 1,000 nuclear reactors. Depending on how many lawsuits are filed per plant, a single plant will have several reactors. A single reactor costs between $3 and $13 billion.
And how many we have online now?
About 100.
100 plus, right?
Right, about 100. $3 billion a pop, that's a lowball figure. That you're looking at $3,000 billion. No, when you take into account the cost of construction of a nuclear power plant, no plant has ever turned more than a very, very minuscule profit. The only reason we have nuclear power, period, is because we've had the oil has been so cheap that it's practically free, so we can build these things. There's also the issue that uranium is subject to Hubbert's peak also, and we only have about 25 years of that left. So nuclear would actually vastly accelerate the problem because we'd be using such an unbelievable amount of oil to construct the number of plants that we need. But on a side note, Bush's proposal to send us $1.6 billion to hydrogen, that if you look at the fine print, that was all actually to go to the nuclear industry to produce hydrogen, which, like I just explained, it's not going to work for, go on the site, page 2, I've listed all so you can look it up.
All right, well, we'll take some more calls. By the way, a plane carrying a Macedonian president, Boris Trajuski, apparently has crashed into the mountains south of Bosnia, according to Macedonian governmental officials. Let's move on as the clock is ticking west of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Hello. Nope. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, this is DJ from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Hi there.
You basically, at the beginning of this segment, already sort of asked the same question about using biomass materials. One of the things about the depletion of growable area or usable land is one of your guests a couple months back was talking about building or helping design the new Ford plant and using plants on top of the roof to help with cooling and such like that, where you could end up using the roofs of buildings. And if we were to change our way of like expansion to where each individual person has to have their own home and depleting the land around and building the cities up instead of out, we could end up keeping ourselves with more land to be able to use to grow.
Well, I tell you what, Matt, it is going to take, as the caller's pointing out, all kinds of different ideas, maybe not just one, to come up with some solutions to at least minimize the impact of using oil.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to be utilizing pretty much all the alternatives for all of their shortcomings. They're all we've got. And, we may think of some other additional things that help us. We're not going to just retrofit our entire nation. But we need to be doing, when you have a crisis like this, you need to look at anything and everything that could possibly work and pursue it, 100%.
So you think we should continue to spend our money for, let's say, space exploration?
Well, space, we're actually going there for three reasons. A, not a surprise, Halliburton's been in the mix with the Mars plan. I detail this on page 4 of the site. Halliburton, I got a quote there from a Halliburton scientist saying, well, we want to go to Mars so we can develop, use the technology we developed there to develop more advanced oil drilling techniques. Then, of course, there's a space-based weapons factor. And finally, there's what's called helium-3 on the moon. Helium-3 is the ideal fuel if you have a fusion reactor, which we've never managed to build. And there's all sorts of other technology that you need to make use of helium-3, which is on the moon. It's not on here. So we're going to space, not to go where no man has gone before, but in a really desperate attempt to address our oil situation here on the planet.
Well, again, you follow the money trail, you find out exactly what is going on. It's a major problem, Matt. Peak oil, of course, is something, like I said earlier, has always piqued my interest, and I want to thank you for at least showing us a little bit about this curve, this bell curve, and where we stand on this thing. In your best prediction, when do you think we really begin to feel this?
2007.
Okay, so we're really close.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're going to see oil. You're going to see there's a couple large oil fields that are coming online probably a year from now. What that's going to do is provide us with a full sense of security because the oil supply is going to go up. Pretty much anything you see in the news, look at it from a peak oil perspective. OPEC, they cut their production because they want to strangle us before we get those Iraqi oil fields online because they know, they know what the oil situation is.
All right, Matt, thank you so much. Your website, lifeafterthedoilcrash.net. Appreciate you being on
Coast
to Coast.
Okay, thank you.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Rob Ismail, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon in St. Louis, Howard Morton, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.